Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When family is all that matters, make sure they're protected. Visit Zurich.ie to learn more about life and serious illness cover.
Eileen, thank you very much for that. Now, 71% are fully vaccinated, 86% are partially vaccinated, that's of adults. And despite the increase in Delta infections and hospitalisations, the COVID vaccine flood wall is holding. Well, to discuss all of this and more, we're joined now by Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Operating Officer of the HSE. And thank you, Colm, for coming into us this evening. So COVID cases, they're still high, over 1,400 yesterday, but the message at the briefing today was they do appear to be plateauing. Is that a trend we can expect to continue?
Well, we've all been looking, Sarah, very carefully at the modelling and the optimistic scenarios and the pessimistic scenarios and the huge variation between them as to how the number of cases will pan out in the coming month or two. And there's a huge gap between what may be upwards of 4,000 admissions or cases per day to September to 14,000-15,000 per day in a very pessimistic scenario. And of course, there's the additional considerations, how do those number of cases translate into harm in terms of hospitalizations, into ITU admissions and so on. Certainly, if you were speaking to me last week, I would have expected to see 2,000 cases per day. We're seeing that 5-day moving average, just about 1,300 cases per day. Bear in mind, it peaked at almost 7,000 per day in January. But we would have settled for this last week. It is too early to say if this is a plateau, because the modelling does tell us that it's going to rise further. However, the trend seems to be certainly on the more optimistic side of that modelling. That's something that we can take some comfort from. I would say, Sarah, so much of this isn't, we're not passive bystanders here. None of us would know that by now. We've learned a hard lesson over the past 18 months. So much of us depends on each and every one of us, how we interact with each other, our vaccination programme, our uptake of vaccination, and of course how we adhere to those well-learned social measures that stop the virus transmitting between individuals and stop onward transmission.
And do we think that's what's going on then, if the modelling would have suggested would be at in around 2,000 cases per day this week, that it is a change in human behaviour that maybe has prevented that? Or do we have any idea why we haven't hit that?
Well, it's too early to say, first of all. But secondly, what we do know is that we've always known that at any of these situations, that looking forward and projecting, that so much of it is in our hands and in the hands of each and every one of us, and the way the choices we make as to how we interact with each other, whether or not we breach those well-learned measures such as distancing and mask wearing and so on, difficult as they may be. So I would hope, and certainly based on while there will always be breaches, I think people are listening, people understand. As they say in Irish, Tuchel Kianiha again, we bought sense over the past 18 months.
Now, cautiously optimistic then on the trend when it comes to cases, but a big increase in hospitalisation, 60% up in a week, which, you know, is the sort of figure that on the face of it sounds very concerning. And yet I was watching the briefing earlier on and I didn't get a real sense of deep concern. Now, maybe I wasn't picking up on it right, but I didn't get that sense. Is it something the HSE is concerned about? Is it something that you would expect to continue? Are we seeing a wave of hospitalizations, increase in hospitalizations coming, do you think?
We've seen a steady rise. There was a big jump over the weekend. We're now at 160, as you point out. That's up 60% from last week, but it is a low number. Again, looking back to January, when we really had uncontrolled community transmission, when there was no flood wall, there was no line of defence, what we saw then was the effect of unmitigated, uncontrolled community transmission, which was inevitable spillover into nursing homes and hospitals and all the disruption and all the pain and anguish that caused. So what we're seeing now is a steady rise, but what we have to, what we don't know yet is what's the impact of that flood wall. There are some early signs from other jurisdictions in England and so on that link between harm and cases has been truly weakened. Not broken, but certainly weakened. And we see, for example, data coming from Public Health England that and from our own experience here, that conversion that we were so used to, for every 1,000 cases, 30 to 50 people admitted, we see that much lower now, maybe 15 or so admitted. So that link has been very severely weakened between cases and hospitalisation, and that's because of the vaccine programme.
Okay. We would have expected 2,000 cases this week due to the modelling. Is there a number on how many hospitalisations we would have expected, and where are we on that?
Well, we're learning more each week because this is a new surge. We've lived through three surges where we were able, unfortunately with monotonous predictability, able to compute how that those number of cases would translate into harm. We're now into an unknown situation, but we're learning more all the time. And as I said, that conversion of cases to hospitalisation, while there's always a lag time, and we've learned that again over the past 8 months, it seems to be a lower conversion. Again, thanks to the vaccine
program. Than what we
would have modelled. And particularly, it's not just the vaccine program and those figures you quoted at the beginning of the program, that the huge 86% partly vaccinated, 71% of the eligible population totally vaccinated. It's who's been vaccinated, who got it first, who got protected first. And like other countries, we zoned in on the most vulnerable, those who are most likely to get the most severe manifestation of the virus, and healthcare workers. And thanks to that strategy, and thanks to those people taking the vaccine up in such numbers and that were beyond our wildest expectations, we're counting figures today. What we can't count, Sarah, is the figures we would have been talking about today if it wasn't for that level of uptake.
Okay. Well, speaking of vaccinations then, we might just look at the next steps in the vaccinations, which is both the 16 to 17 year old age group, which I know has, I think it's begun, has it? And what has the response been like there?
It's good. There's about 140,000, 150,000 this age group. We've seen over 60,000 register so far. So that what has surprised some of us, I have to say, is we saw that those astonishing levels of uptake in older groups, and people were able to say, well, that's because they have so much to fear from the virus, and that's absolutely. But we're seeing this translate right through the age groups going down to 30, 39s. Big levels of uptake, huge numbers of people who registered for the vaccine. And similarly, in younger age groups who have much less to fear from the virus, still registering in high numbers. There may be different motivations, but I'd like to think and believe that there is this this community, this sense of community and sense of solidarity that has got us so far in the past 18, through some very difficult times in the past 18 months, is in some part the cause behind these high levels of uptake in all age groups.
So perhaps the biggest question mark around the vaccination programme thus far has been around the 12 to 15 years age group, and that is something that is going to be focused on in the coming weeks. Now, speaking yesterday on Today with Claire Byrne, Professor Karina Butler, who's chair of NIAC, was explaining NIAC's recommendations with regard to this age group. Let's just take a quick listen to what she had to say.
We recommended that the vaccine should be offered to everyone 12 to 15 years of age. We recommended that those who had underlying medical conditions, the kind of conditions we've talked about, for example, if someone was immunosuppressed, if someone has bad chest or lung disease or neurologic disability that interferes with their swallowing and their secretions, very strong, we would encourage those to get out and get the vaccine as soon as it is offered. We think there's another group, for example, those who might be living in the household where there's a younger child that's at risk, or maybe an older person who mightn't have responded so well for the vaccine, i.e., for example, an immunocompromised person. And that group of children, their parents may want to really get out and get there. And then for that wider group, it really does come to the offer is there for parents to make that judgment. But when we looked at it, we believe that the benefits outweigh the risks for all children, and that's why we recommend that the offer be made.
All right, so when you listen to Professor Butler there, she's saying that those with underlying conditions or someone who's living with someone with underlying conditions, she's recommending they should get the vaccine at the earliest possible opportunity, which chimes with what we've heard from NIAC and authorities throughout, really recommend at the earliest possible opportunity. The best vaccine is the one in your arm, all of that we've heard. But then when it comes to the wider population, she's saying that she recommended the offer would be there and the benefits outweigh the risks. It's not quite as clear cut. Is that the same message from yourselves?
Yes, I think it's important to understand and to appreciate Professor Butler. I have huge admiration for her utter integrity right through this process. And what she said also in that interview is she was deciding what was for the benefit of the child. And that's what they did in NIAC. Is that, there was all kinds of noise here about we'll get to more of the population. If we get to this age group, it'll stand to benefit for us all and so on. But they focused on what was for the benefit of children. And hence there was a hierarchy of recommendations. First of all, for those children with underlying conditions that make them more vulnerable to illness from COVID, not just mild illness or asymptomatic illness, but something that potentially severe, albeit less common than you'd find in older age groups. They were making a definitive recommendation for those people. Mm. And also for those living with those in a household with somebody who could become ill should they contract the virus. So she was quite definitive, and I am quite definitive about that. But sticking to the same principle of what is in the interests of the child, they're offering the vaccine, but certainly recommending that considering all the risks and benefits, that it's in the greater interest for children to get the vaccine. But that's up to children, for parents and guardians to make the decision based on properly furnished information. And we've tried very hard, sir, to be consistent with this from the beginning when it comes to any group, is to provide them with all the information they need to make a decision for themselves and not to feel coerced.
Okay, so the HRC is fully in line with NIAC on this in
completely.
Terms of the messaging.
There's nothing between us and that, no.
All right. Now, I want to ask you about maternity hospitals. I know you had quite a lot of figures at the briefing today. You did a survey of the 19 maternity hospitals and how compliant they are with the guidelines that allow partners to attend with pregnant women at various different types of appointments. Of the 19 hospitals, can you tell us how many are fully compliant?
Yes. First of all, I could say briefly, Sarah, nobody wanted to be in this position, least of all the staff in the maternity hospitals who understand, as professionals and people who've dedicated their careers to this kind of work, that it's a whole experience, not just that it's such a positive experience bringing a child into the world that involves the woman, partner and family and so on. It was the virus and the havoc it caused that left us in this situation, not just in maternity hospitals, but in nursing homes and hospitals and elsewhere. So as that surge of cases in January and February abated, we were able to incrementally reintroduce those visiting. And in the first iteration of that, where we looked at visits in postnatal wards, the presence of a partner on labour wards, the presence of a partner for an anomaly scan at 20 weeks, and the parents visiting neonatal intensive care units, all 19 maternity units are compliant with those four now. We further eased the restrictions at 23rd of June to looking at early pregnancy assessment units, and that's kind of a booked clinic where people go during early pregnancy for particular investigations or presentation, routine visits for women of a higher risk pregnancy and for emergency presentations in late gestation. And the great majority of units are complying, either are fully compliant with this, some are partly compliant, and there are some issues with infrastructure. For example, one hospital I can think of where the early pregnancy assessment units is a tight constrained area, and we have to be mindful, I know it's difficult to say this, we have to be mindful also of the risk that Delta presents to women and pregnancy, and make sure that in easing these restrictions, we do so in a way that we don't introduce a new risk at a time there's a surge in Delta cases, and allowing at the same time that vaccine programme to penetrate through these younger age groups so we can afford protection to all. So I expect we'll be able to be fully compliant, even with those partially compliant hospitals, in the coming weeks. And then if the trend continues, which is the vaccine programme uptake, as in the numbers we've seen and the protections given, there's no reason why we can't progress to return to normality as soon as we can.
Okay.
But it has been a tough journey for people. I appreciate the hurt it's caused, and nobody wanted this to happen. But we had, in making these decisions about infection prevention control measures, we were in a very difficult situation. Mm. We were trying to protect women and pregnancies and their pregnancies too.
Okay, and we might just take a closer look at some of those figures you've just given us there. So I think it's 7 of the country's 19 maternity hospitals are only partially compliant with the guidelines permitting partners to accompany women with high-risk pregnancies. Now, women with high-risk pregnancies, in and of itself, routine visits, there's no such thing as a routine visit if you have a high-risk pregnancy. Every visit is, you know, laden with stress and concern. And yet, 7 maternity units are saying no to partners. Do you have reasons for that?
When you said it's no, they're partially compliant. They're not completely compliant. And in many of these cases, it's where there's a pre-arranged visit that goes ahead. But what we're trying to do is work with these centres, as we did with those first 4 centres, to make sure there's full compliance. We want to see full compliance. The vaccination programme is giving us the confidence and should give the hospitals the confidence, even the backdrop of these Delta cases, to allow us to comply with all these recommendations.
Yeah, but this easing of the guidelines, that one that you've mentioned there, and also women presenting at emergency departments in the late stages of their pregnancies, 4 units partially compliant with that. I mean, does that mean there are 4 units around the country where a woman who, for example, might be 34 weeks pregnant and she could go into a restaurant with her partner, or she could get on a plane with her partner, or she could go to a wedding with 100 people with her partner, but if she has a bleed and she has to go to an emergency department, she has to leave her partner outside in 4 units around the country. Is that really the situation?
I understand, but I wouldn't equate a restaurant with a healthcare facility, the risk of Delta poses in a healthcare facility is much more considerable than the risk of Delta or a variant or any version of the COVID in a restaurant or a plane or elsewhere. Mm. It is different. We've learned again the hard way the impact of outbreaks in these settings. We are aware that Delta variant in particular has an additional risk to women in their pregnancies, and there's data coming through in that showing not just the case of placentitis we've seen, but also that once women become sick or admitted to hospital, there's a higher conversion rate to need for ITU. Now, this is rare, but nevertheless, we have an obligation to protect.
Sure, Colm, and I think everyone accepts that, and pregnant women absolutely want to be safe, you know, and they want to feel safe when they're in maternity units. But we have the vaccine, and under the vaccine, we have COVID certs, and under the COVID certs we're allowing people into restaurants and we're allowing people onto planes. So why can't we allow people with COVID certs, proof that they're fully vaccinated, into emergency departments?
We can, and we've seen huge progress in these figures, and I absolutely intend that we'll see full compliance in all these units in the coming week or two. And we're engaging with these units to make sure that happens.
Because you announced this in relation to the emergency departments example, I think a month ago. The HSC announced the relaxation of those guidelines. So that's a month of situations where women are presenting at emergency departments in these really distressing situations and being left alone. You know, like what's going on?
I understand, Sarah. A month has been a long time. In that month, we've seen a surge in cases that has led to the level, a five-day average of cases, way in excess of what we saw 1 month ago. If we had known a month ago what was ahead of us in terms of the Delta variant, of course we would have tempered our predictions. What we've learned is from this pandemic is the incredible volatility that it has brought with us, and the incredible disruption and pain that it's caused people, including whether it's illness.
Can you understand why women around the country be looking at this and thinking, well, here we are coming last again, looking at the full restaurants, looking at the Taoiseach talking about 18,000 people in Crow Park, you know, as a possibility, looking at people getting on planes and heading into their appointments by themselves, you know.
Sir, we want to have full compliance in all units with these. Okay. We want to do so in a safe way.
Okay. So you're hopefully your plan and expectation is within 2 weeks.
Yes.
Okay. I think that'll be very positive and hopeful news for all those women out there, and indeed their partners who. I think we very much welcome that. But thank you very much for joining us this evening. That's
welcome.
Dr. Colm Henry, who's Chief Operation Officer of the HSE. You can let us know your own thoughts to 51551. You can tweet the programme as well at DriveTimeRTE.